Hello, folks, and welcome back to the second episode of the Jersey Ontario podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bauman. Well, the reviews are in, and the pilot episode was met with critical acclaim. I thought I'd take a moment to share some of the great listener feedback we received. Some guy from Midland wrote in, "Went better than I had imagined." Another comment was, "I don't think it turned out too bad." Finally, and I think this one might have come from my wife, "The host has a face for radio and a voice for silent film." So, positivity all around to start off. Maybe next month I'll read some of the bad reviews. Carrying right along with notes of success, I misled everybody at the end of the last episode by saying we'd be talking about forages this month. But we're actually going to save that episode for next month. I got thinking it could be interesting to first do a bit on the history of Jersey, Ontario, the structure of the organization, and what its mandate is. Joining me today to discuss this topic is Chris Kyle, who operates Ashlawn Farms with his father George and brother Carmen, is a past president of Jersey, Ontario, and a walking, talking history textbook for all things Jersey and Ontario. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me on, Eric. And yeah, I think it's a good opportunity to give a little bit of a history lesson, perhaps, and on where we've been, where the club's been or the organization's been and where it could go from here.
So I'm still a relative newcomer to the Jersey, Ontario community. I think we met for the first time in 2015, maybe at our parish meeting. I got the impression that everybody knows you, but tell us a little bit about yourself anyways.
All right. So we farm outside of Ayr, just south of Ayr. We milk a herd of approximately 50 Jerseys. Yeah, I grew up on this farm here. We currently farm with my father, George, and then my brother, Carmen, and then his wife, Jen, and their kids, Callum and Maddie.
Okay. So, Chris, what you're on the farm now. I know that you told me once that you worked a little bit as an AI technician. Do I have that right?
Yep. I worked during I worked summers when I was at university with it was GenCorp that time. So they trained me. I worked in the summers, and then I worked at GenCorp after graduation for a few years. And then I had been a relief technician or a swingman for several years for different companies after that. I don't do that anymore, but I was probably breeding cows for 15 years, likely, if you include the time in school, and got to see a lot of operations and a lot of southwestern Ontario that way. So that's where most of my off-farm stuff comes from.
What was the best part about that experience?
I think getting to see the different operations, some different geography. I know we remodeled the tie stall barn here. And so there was a couple weeks where I kept a tape measure in my pocket. And if the stall looked to be a good size around the cow, I took a couple quick measurements, you know, like head rail height or stall width, and then took a quick measurement of the cow to do backwards math down to Jersey size. So you get to see little things like that, meet a lot of people when they're around. And yeah, so when you get to go around a few different places, you get to steal some good ideas and get rid of some bad ideas if you're trying to do something different. And you see a lot of different kind of cows too. If you just stay at home, you don't. Yeah, you'll have a hard time knowing just maybe where your herd is in the world, and seeing different cows, and it was really interesting. Growing up around this area, we have a lot of pretty nice-looking Jersey cows. So if I never left the county, I would think every county's got master breeders and all Canadians and royal winners and production champions, and my cows aren't that good. And then you go for a drive, and you find out there's lots of average cows like you got. Once you go a little further away, but the barn, seeing the different buildings was really neat. And the different set, because you literally got into every setup. Yeah, it was kind of neat just to see everywhere else.
I feel like this concept of getting rid of the bad ideas is probably just as important as the good ideas that you can steal, because I feel like I often have some bad ideas and I don't always have the chance to get rid of them, because I don't get out that much. Your prefix is Ashlawn. Your farm's been around for a long time. Tell us a little bit about the history of your farm and the story behind your prefix.
Yeah, so it's Ashlawn Farms. The prefix comes from the simple fact that there was two large ash trees on the front lawn. And that's how the name came about. My family got into Jerseys quite some time ago. So my great-grandfather, John Kyle, started milking Jerseys in 1928. And they shipped cream to the Acme Farmers Dairy in Toronto, is where they started shipping cream. Then my grandfather, Bob Kyle, moved one farm north. And so we've always been in the air area. In 1948 or 49, and they started milking Jerseys here with the Ashland prefix. The prefix prior to that at the other farm was Kyle Croft. It would be my great uncle and great aunts milked cows at the other farm until I believe the early 70s when they got out of the Jersey business. So the Kyle family's been milking cows for, well, quite some time, not quite 100 years. Just pretty close. And then there's a lot of old history in the area. So some other herds people might have heard of. Harold Butcher had Bell City Jerseys, and they started south of Brantford in the early 30s. Now, Harold Butcher comes up quite often in history of the Jersey breed. So Harold Butcher would be Jenny Butcher's or Jason Butcher's great-grandfather. And so they started in Brantford. They then moved to the Princeton area, and then were two herds there. So Bell City kept going in one herd, and under Tom McDougall, married Keith Butcher's daughter. So they started milking cows there and kept the Bell City prefix until, a few years back, they would have dispersed. And then Grand Claire got started up, which was Grant Butcher. And that would be Jenny Butcher or Jason Butcher's grandfather. And they started up in that Princeton area and milked cows there. Then Jason and Jenny's father moved to Ayr about 2 miles straight east of us here and started the Brenby herd. And then Jenny Butcher, actually Tan Bark Jerseys, I don't believe would be too far from where Butcher started milking cows back in 1930. Wow. So it's kind of funny how the world works and it all kind of circles around. And then you got Sales's. Sales's have been milking Jerseys at Spruce Avenue since 1932. And so that was started by Theodore Sales, which would be Dean Sr. and Brian's grandfather, started in 1932. And then their father, Bert Sales, took over from that. And then so that farm is still the same. Spruce Avenue is still in the same place there. And that, of course, now has Dean Jr. farming. And they would have won 3 master breeders now, I think. And Dean Jr.'s there, and his sons, Charlie and Carson, would be the fifth generation there. So there's five generations, if you count the little kids in grade school in this area, have played with Jerseys. So we've been at it a long time. Wow. And and even old Judd's there, Thomas Judd. So his family got into Jerseys. So Thomas Judd would be the fourth generation. And his family got into Jerseys in 46, I think it was, down at Simcoe. So they're in the same, we're in the same county parish, Grant Norfolk Club. So they've been at it a long time. They just got a Master Breeder Award as well. Yes, so there's lots of history in the area, and that's maybe why you kind of pick up some history on the way, just from the fact of just being surrounded by it.
Yeah, Judds are this year's Master Breeders recipients. So congratulations to them, and thanks for bringing that up. Thanks for the history lesson, first of all. That's really interesting to hear how many longstanding herds are in that area, right close to where you are. You're a past president of Jersey Ontario. You've been involved with the organization for a while. What was your experience like when you were on the board?
Well, I enjoyed my time on the board. Now, I can't remember dates. My history is not nearly as interesting. So I don't know any of my own dates, but I would have joined the board in about the middle of the 2000s. I think I was on the board for about 10 years. And before that was Rick Stern. So Richard Stern from Potwell Jerseys, they sold their cows. So he stepped off the board and then I replaced him. And Rick actually came on to replace my father, George. So my dad, George, was on the board through essentially the 90s. He was on the board and president. And then before him, he replaced, he would have replaced Dean had replaced Brian Sales, his brother, at Brighton. And then Brian Sales had replaced, I'm pretty sure, Bert Sales, their father was on the board too. They had all been presidents all in a row. Oh, so wow. There's a little bit of a family history to it, which is probably why I got on it. Or I was aware of Jersey Ontario meetings because my father was on the board ahead of time. So that gives you a bit of a heads up. But I enjoyed my time on it. You get to meet, as far as the board level goes, you get to meet some producers from different areas, some breeders from further away. And then at the meetings, you'll get to meet some other people. And, there's directors that I was on the board with that I still talk to almost daily and that you might not have otherwise run into each other. I don't know where else, for instance, you and I would run into each other if not for that connection, just from geography on two opposite sides of the world. So it's kind of, that's the thing I remember most. The details of it, I mean, boards have good days and bad days, and they all sort out. So there's nothing too exciting that way. But that's the biggest thing, is the people you get to meet.
Yeah, and I agree with that. In my experience so far, is that the biggest win has been meeting people and creating connections that otherwise I would not have had the chance to make. What is the function of Jersey Ontario? And if you can just briefly describe its structure.
The function of Jersey, the simplest way to explain the function of Jersey Ontario is I found in the original constitution, it laid out a set of goals, but I don't think much has changed. So in the original constitution, the goals were to promote and encourage production and the distribution of Jersey milk and its products. And at that time, they had actually had a trademark of Jersey-specific milk they were selling. Collect fees from its members to pay for that work. Promote breed improvement and the establishment of Jersey herds in AI use and whatnot, better management. Assist members in the sale of Jersey cattle, whether that's directly with sales or individually, kind of through word of mouth. And then to encourage and assist with Jersey shows. And then, of course, encourage milk recording and classification. And then hold meetings for the study of the breed and management improvement. So I'm not, other than we're not in the business of selling Jersey milk directly as they were, I don't know that anything's really changed very much in the, as far as a grand scheme of things. The big picture is still pretty much the same as far as Jersey Ontario goes. Its structure has always been, or essentially, it lays out a set of county clubs or parish clubs. So everybody probably has some idea what. So in our case, we're in the Brant Norfolk Club. I think you're Leeds Grenville, maybe. Is that the name of yours? Yeah.
Yeah. So yes.
It lays out all these different clubs. And each club or county club sends a director that forms the board. It's been the tradition that you stay on the board and then it rotates through to president, essentially in order of the way they joined the club, for lack of a better way to put that. In your president year, that's the club that holds the annual meeting. So that's how that gets shifted around.
Right.
And so I'm not, now the number of parish clubs and directors changes a bit. It was 12. Is it 10 or 11 now?
I believe right now there's 11, but one is vacant. One directorship is vacant currently, I believe. But if I'm wrong, we can just edit that bit out. It's okay.
Yeah, but that's essentially how it's always worked in the more recent times. Yeah, so they meet as a board. The board has their elects an executive, would be a president, vice president, and then two additional vice presidents. I forget what they're called now. And then that sets up your succession as far as your presidency goes. And it, in turn, that sets up your succession to your annual meeting planning too for your home club is why that gets designed that way.
So the organization was founded in the late 40s. What are the roots of the organization and why was it established?
So the official, so at that time it was the Ontario Jersey Club. And then we changed the name to Jersey Ontario, but it was created on the 1st of April in 1946. And it was the amalgamation of the Ontario Jersey Cattle Breeders Association with the Ontario Trademark Milk Shippers Association. So that's its connection to selling Jersey-specific milk, the milk marketing of Jersey milk. And it sold underneath the Jersey Queen of Quality trademark at that time. So that's how it got its start in 46. That first year, they held a sale in Richmond Hill. And they sold 38 head for an average of $302. So our average at our sales is does a little bit better now, but $302 was a lot of money in 1946. They had some judging schools and whatnot. By 1948, they made a milk committee. The first milk committee it was appointed, and that consisted of a W.D. Thompson, Jack Pauley, and then Harold Butcher that we talked about before.
Yeah.
So he'd be the great grandfather of the butchers that some people know now, or the grandfather. And so that was started in 48. So from a really early time in Jersey, Ontario's history, they were getting into milk marketing, milk marketing and the policies behind it.
Yeah. In the late 60s, quota is introduced and DFO comes to existence. At the time, Jersey milk was being marketed by the Channel Island Breeds Milk Marketing Association. What's the connection between the Channel Island Breeds Milk Marketing Association and Jersey, Ontario?
So in 1950, Jersey, Ontario took its trademark of Queen of Quality and they joined it with the Jersey Canada's All Jersey Milk program, which was called All Jersey. So those two joined forces in 1950. And then, in 1956, Jersey, Ontario voted to leave the Toronto Whole Milk Producers Association, which would have been made up of mostly Holstein breeders, of course. At the time, that group was essentially promoting against all Jersey milk. So that wasn't going to work. So Jersey Ontario and Jersey Canada, the All Jersey program, joined with Guernsey breeders in 1956. And that's what formed the Channel Islands Milk Producers Association. So Guernsey Island is another small island, along with Jersey Island, their neighbors. And that's why those two breeds worked together. They each had their own segregated milk programs at the time. So that group got together and they fought for the rights of the segregated milk, essentially, and would so for a while until... At that time, it was called the Whole Milk League, and there was a fair bit of, they wanted to change the pricing on milk, which would They referred to it as the butterfat differential. What it would actually do is they would make all Jersey milk too expensive for processors to buy. And you'd actually get taken out of the program or taken out of the market by just being too expensive. So that's what brings up some of the fights, or the fight's a bad word, but the
disagreements
that happen there. So now from this program, the segregated milk program is where we see the, we used to call them deductions. And that's how Jersey Ontario funded itself. So they would collect fees for a percentage of your Jersey milk you sold. And that money was used to promote or market that milk.
So essentially there's a checkoff on our milk check as Jersey producers going to the Jersey organization. The Jersey organization in turn was using that money to promote all Jersey milk and create an expanding market for all Jersey milk. So essentially we are creating and then filling our own market as Jersey dairy farmers, correct?
Yes. And it was quite lucrative. Yeah. In 1963, they added a Jersey cream jug. And so that was to reduce the butterfat because they were skimming the all Jersey milk to 2%. So they had to do something with the extra cream. So the all Jersey milk programs were just dealing with fluid products. They weren't processing milk further than that. And by 1964, they're collecting, Jersey Ontario was collecting $235,000 worth of producer deductions yearly to fund it, which is, I think, bigger than the budget is now. And was worth a lot more money then.
Yes.
And there's actually still the remnants of that system on a few herds still use that system to make donations to Jersey Ontario as it is now, as opposed to the regional development fee that is kind of the modern version of that. So there's a little bit of that still left. We used to call them deductions in my day, and they're voluntary support members is what they're called now. And so that was through the 60s, somewhere in here. I got to find the year. They had milk sales in the late 60s of like $8 million. Like they were selling a whack of milk in the late 60s prior to Ontario Milk Marketing Board. And with the segregated milk, it was quite a successful business.
The Ontario Milk Marketing Board, of course, being the precursor to the current organization of DFO.
Yeah.
So
because they DFO discovered they weren't very good at marketing milk, so they took that out of their names, we said at one time. Wow. So Jersey guys still don't like them. Nothing's changed.
So in the late 60s, the Channel Island Breeds Milk Marketing Association and the Ontario Milk Marketing Association have some differing opinions when it comes to the introduction of quota. What happened to the Channel Island Breeds Milk Marketing Association at the end of its existence?
So we have DFO gets started up. We'll use the modern names and just for simplicity. So DFO gets started up and they change milk policy, which effectively eliminates milk segregation, for lack of a better term. So it eliminates the All Jersey Milk Program. In 1968, Jersey Ontario creates a milk committee of Morris Beattie, who was Lindale Jersey's, who was real, is a very prominent breeding. And it features quite heavily in the 50s and 60s and the 70s in Jersey pedigrees. If you go back far enough, you'll run into Lindale bulls. Morris Beattie was in that, I'm going to say, Milton area. Harold Butcher was on that committee, who we've talked about, and Frank Stanger, who some people remember from Inniskillen, Jerseys, where the Sargent's family is now. So Frank Stanger was on that committee, and that milk committee recommended legal action against the milk board in the late 60s, which they did. Now, history says they lost, But there's some really neat stories that maybe they should have won, but some lawyers made some deals and interesting stories like that. But they were ruled against, but they fought to be able to sell Jersey Milk. They lost that argument. So then milk essentially became milk. Milk is milk is milk. So that puts Jersey Ontario out of the milk marketing business, well, by 1970.
As the organization at that point then sort of needs to figure out how it's going to continue to exist and create an income for itself and create a mission statement for itself, or to carry on with the other mission statements that it had other than milk marketing, what did that evolution look like over the next, say, 10, 20, 30 years for Jersey Ontario? What were some of the high points and low points?
So they started having, well, they were hosting other events. So that put them out of the milk marketing business. So essentially, they were going to switch to the Jersey cow marketing business, which is what they were doing before, just by way of the milk. So now they're going to try to promote Jersey cows as a whole. So, for instance, in 1967, that was the first calf rally that I think most people will be aware about. And 1967, they had a calf rally in Galt, which is a suburb of Cambridge in the KW down here, this area. And it had it featured 243 calves shown.
Wow.
But by 1970, once the milk system went to not specifically selling Jersey milk, and this is all before component pricing, so milk is milk is milk, and it's worth so much a liter, Jersey started disappearing. So you see a shift away from Jersey's into more Holsteins. And at Jersey's used to be pretty popular. So if you pay attention to the registration records, when they say, oh, this is our best year since, quite often it'll be the best year for Jersey registration since sometime in the late 60s there, or early 60s, when that milk program was really moving. 1970s, our cow sales kind of disappear. And I know in notes I found you could buy open heifers for $75 for export and bred heifers for $150 to $175. So the bottom fell right out of that market. And that's kind of where that would be the low of Jersey Ontario, so to speak.
And at this point, just to remind listeners that earlier you mentioned the all Ontario sale, or whatever the name of that sale was, had an average selling price of over $300 per head, right?
Yeah. So in so that was 46. They were averaging 300. So in real dollars, they lost a lot of value to get. Yeah, that's a good point. They've lost a tremendous amount of value. At that time, Frank Stanger and some other people got together and created a Jersey Cattlemen of Canada, which acted as brokers for cattle sales and operated out of Ontario. And they started selling cattle domestically and export. And the efforts of Frank Stanger, and then there was a fieldman for Ontario, Bill Teasdale, in the late 70s, they were able to move a fair number of cattle through the export market. And they got that developed, and it improved quickly. 1980, if you find the notes for the Jersey Cattlemen annual meeting, they had sales of over $75,000 in cattle. And that's thanks in part to Jersey Ontario, and at that time, their fieldman, Bill Teasdale. And so that's kind of where they came back as. And Gene Grisdale was hired as the secretary manager of Jersey Ontario. And then they hired David Parkinson as fieldman. Now, David Parkinson would eventually work for the American Jersey Cattle Club, as I believe he's retired now. But he worked with the Americans as a fieldman for them. So it's kind of the work in the 70s. It was a lot of work just to exist. But they seemed to have done, they did a good job, and they were able to exist. And they kind of developed a pretty good marketing program as far as moving cattle. in the export market, it would matter right up and through the 90s. It was a significant funding of breeders. We used to sell a lot of cattle to Mexico, and the hot countries is where the Jerseys would excel. There was a pretty good market for high-end show cattle through Brazil and Colombia to some extent. Brazil really mattered in the 90s. And that was all through this work of the some of these people with connected to Jersey, Ontario to export cattle.
So that's quite a road to recovery. I think about the health of the organization today or my experience with it, and it's hard to imagine it sort of being at such a low point and struggling, and the Jersey breed in general struggling for to gain traction and a foothold. Today there's a fair number of farms that are introducing Jerseys into their herd or switching completely to Jerseys to capitalize on the components and to reduce some feed costs. And so that's, you know, a very inspiring story in some ways, I think. If you look at the organization now, as it exists today, how do you evaluate its relevance to the industry? And do you feel like it still serves a role and in the industry today?
I do. I think breed associations do have a place in the industry. I think they have to always evolve, like we talked about. So it's a matter of finding jobs to do for the association and that kind of fit the times. And I do think they still have a place. I think Jersey, Ontario has, I think there's room for Jersey, Ontario and a Jersey, Canada. Jersey, Ontario is one of the higher concentrations of the breed. So it has a history and it has some finances where it can operate. So when it needs to, it can work on things that, instead of Jersey, Ontario or Jersey, Canada. Sorry. And then sometimes they can work together if there's mutual benefit there or where it can work. You can work with Jersey, Ontario and Jersey, Canada can work together, maybe get a few more things done. So I really do think there's a place for it. If you go back, if you go find some old Jersey breeders from the 80s, you'll find lots of notes from the, there's always been a milk committee. So the lobby that would lobby the Ontario Milk Marketing Board or DFO. And so you'll find notes in the mid 80s. Ross Campbell was a big feature then. He milked Jerseys at Hixson. He had a really good sense of milk policy and had his kind of understood the pulse of things. Francis Rattlemeyer at Don Head Jerseys was the same way. They knew what. So you can go back and find a Jersey breeder from 1985, read an article written by those two men about the problem with too much skim milk powder in the system. And you'll read it and you'll go, oh, that's from, this must be a new email from DFO. And it's not. It's a letter from Jersey, Ontario Milk Marketing Committee saying there's a problem with this, we should get on it. And like they could recognize those things in 1980 and we're talking about it. We have multiple component pricing in part because of the influence of Jersey, Ontario. And Ontario, I believe, was one of the first places to get it. And that's because those same people and the boards and all those Jersey producers argued that the component levels, that milk should be priced on fat and protein and not on water. That was a major focus early on. Even now you see Jersey, Ontario still working with SNF because DFO still doesn't take their advice and fix it. And so there's still announcements and it's still stuff that's relevant and they're working on. There's still calf rallies and everybody doesn't show cows, but I think those junior events, it's a good way to get kids involved and maybe learn some secondhand stockmanship, for lack of a better word, and develop a like of cows. and liking cows and recognizing cows, having a bit of a cow sense so that you see things going wrong before they have gone wrong, will help you milk cows as a profession later on. So I think all those things are good. And I think there's still value in kind of the fellowship end of it, getting together as breeders. When I was a kid, I went going to school. We had brown cows and gray tractors from white. And we had white-faced sheep. And all my friends had black and white cows and green tractors and black-faced sheep. And, well, you just got picked on. Well, now it's kind of cool to have brown cows, and white faced sheep are all right too, for what it's worth. And it's just because of the effort, because the club through time has recognized the challenges, and then the producers and the board and the membership work against those challenges to get them fixed for the good of the industry. Multiple component pricing is good for the industry, and solids non-fat, cutting back powdered milk is good for the industry. It doesn't just make Jersey guys money. It makes everybody money. And I think that's been a strength of it. And now we're going to get to a time where, you know, it would be nice if these cows were kind of smaller, and if they didn't eat so much, and if they were A2 and BB, well, and pretty high in components. Well, it turns out little brown cows do all those things and always have. And somebody has to be there making sure people know. And I think that's its value right now. It's just being able to kind of fill that void. So there's kind of a united voice to it. If you just relied on individual breeders, it's not as effective to the industry as when you kind of have a united group behind it.
Yeah, that's some really interesting insight. And I hope it makes people realize the value that the organization has contributed and hopefully still and will continue to contribute to the industry. Chris, we're just about out of time, but I would really like to thank you for coming on today, for giving us this history lesson. As always, it's been a real treat to talk to you. And really interesting, and I hope that our listeners get as much out of it as I did.
No, thanks for having me, and it was a good excuse to go read some old Jersey breeders and do some digging. And it's good. I think it's good to remember your history, and then use that information to make better decisions for the future. So hopefully, people learned something or got something out of it. Hopefully, I didn't tell too many lies, and I kept it old enough. There's maybe not too many people left that'll know if I was lying, but but some of the guys that know if I'm lying, I know well enough, they'll tell me I was lying. No, thanks for the opportunity. I think this is a really neat idea. Just another simple little thing that Jersey Ontario can do. And yeah, it's kind of a neat little initiative.
Take care, Chris.
Thank you.
That brings us almost to the end of this edition of the Jersey Ontario podcast. But before we go, I wanted to highlight some of the upcoming events in the Jersey community. The Jersey Canada Annual General Meeting will be taking place from March 31st to April 1st in Lévis, Quebec. The first Jersey Canada meeting I attended was 11 years ago in Quebec City, just on the other side of the river there, and it's a great place to visit, so if you're able to go, I would definitely encourage you to attend the meeting and maybe take an extra day to see the sights of the old city. Jersey Ontario will be holding the Ontario Invitational Sale on April 8th. This year, the sale will be held at a new venue for us, the Grand River Raceway in Elora, which promises to be a great spot for the event. Yet again, there is a wonderful lineup of consignments ranging from young calves to mature cows. Another first for the sale this year is that it will be a hybrid sale, making online bidding possible for anyone not able to attend the event in person. It is possible to go and view the cattle on site April 7th, so feel free to head out and take a look around before placing your bid. Finally, the Ontario Spring Discovery Show will take place at the Ancaster Fairgrounds April 19th to 20th and kick off this year's show season. Thank you for listening. Please join me next month when I sit down with Dr. Maxime Leduc to discuss forage crops and forage analyses. So long for now.